department is I've changed my title since I originally submitted it. Although I love talking about our quantum data compression experiment, eventually I decided the car isn't big enough for all of my children. I had to leave one at home, and that's the one who got left out. So anyone who wants to talk about that, I'm happy to talk to you about it later over lunch or whatever. But I wanted to bring the baby, the tunneling time experiment, out today. So I'll tell you about some slightly different things. And this is a picture of our lab, two former students, Dylan and Lee. And it's like putting up a picture of real quantum measurement, because I think we often get too tied up in the formalism of quantum measurement. And I want to remind you that measurement means people staring at something trying to figure out what it's doing, and quantum measurement is people staring at a quantum thing trying to figure out what it's doing. So I'm going to tell you about some experimental measurement trade-offs in quantum mechanics, going from Heisenberg to amplified single photons to tunneling times. Forgive me for a little bit of a smorgasbord. And for those of you who have trouble seeing the bottom of the screen, I've done my best to put the references to our work at the top and the references to our competitors at the bottom, so hopefully that won't matter. So I'm going to tell you, roughly speaking, about past, present, and future. I want to say a few words about some historical issues in quantum measurement, a very brief reminder about weak measurements, Aharonov's theory, because I thought the audience here would be likely to be somewhat familiar with that. It occurs to me that might have been a misestimate, but still, in a few slides, I'll give you what I think the important idea for the kind of work we do is. And then I'll talk about one somewhat old experiment we've done using that, about how you can measure how big the disturbance due to measurements is, or are, or something is, I think, and some surprises that we had when we were measuring that. And then I'll tell you about our most recent exciting work, still under review, how to count a single photon and get a result of 8, one of the paradoxes that arises with weak measurements. But I'll talk a little bit about the context there, the experimental context, why we're interested in getting big optical nonlinearities, how we do this experiment, and whether or not this so-called weak value amplification is good for anything, the trade-offs that now arise when you look at the signal-to-noise ratio you really get. And I'll leave some open questions. And then the future, which is actually something I've been talking about for 20 years, but my students are finally reaching the point where they may be able to do it in the lab, is the question, can you ask where a tunneling particle has spent its time after it's been transmitted through that forbidden region? And I'll show you some of the elements of this experiment and the progress that we've made so far. So first of all, just to give acknowledgement to the people who've been involved in this work, this is a list of most of the people who've been in the group for quite some time now, and the people in bold and red are the ones who contributed mostly to the work I'll be telling you about now. I'll try to point to them as we get to the different experiments. So first, let me just make a general point about what I like to think of as quantum archaeology. The question is, can we reason about the past? The way we're all taught quantum mechanics, you're given a state now, you propagate it forward in time, and after you see a photon hit some point on a screen, you don't ask where it was before it hit that point on the screen. You only ask about the result of the measurement you actually did, not things before that. And that's very different to the approach we usually take in science, where I dig up a fossil and I conclude what was going on 65 million years ago based on the fossil I'm looking at now. And in everyday life, of course, we reason from the present about the past. Can't we do that in quantum mechanics? So this is why I'm interested in what people call weak measurements. I don't like that term. I think it would have been safer if we had just thought of them as conditional measurements. And here's the basic setup. Imagine that there's some system that you prepared in some state I, and later on found in some state F, and you want to know what was it doing between I and F. So you want to think about some observable A, let's say, and ask, what can I say about the value of A between that preparation and that post-selection? Do I have to say all I know about it is based on the preparation because I propagate forward in time? Or can you say, well, the Schrödinger equation is time reversible. I could start with F, propagate backwards in time, and learn something about A. Or should you say that you learn just as much from the preparation and from the post-selection? So Aharonov fundamentally thought that due to the time reversibility of the Schrödinger equation, it would make sense to get as much information from both I and F. You might object that the reason that breaks down is because if I truly measured A, the uncontrollable, irreversible disturbance that Bohr claims is involved in a measurement, would mean the game is off and I can't really think about continuing that evolution straightforward to F, at least not in the same coherent sense you might otherwise do. And One way to get around that is to say, that would be true if I did a really accurate measurement of A, because a really accurate measurement disturbs the system greatly. But if I let this system interact only very weakly with some measuring device, that measuring device can't disturb the system very much, can't really affect the coherent evolution from I to F. And of course, the flip side of that, as we'll see, is that you don't get a whole lot of information about A. So what you have to do is repeat this experiment millions of times and find the average value of A. And there are many people who object to that and say, well, that's not what a measurement is. A measurement is, you know, a projection operator. You either get one eigenvalue or you get another. That's simply not true in the real world. Measurements are almost always things that are noisy, that we average millions of times in order to get average shifts. So this really is a natural extension of what we mean in the experimental world by measurements. So I have a cartoon to illustrate how this works out and how it allows you to do this post-selection. Imagine we've got some system in some wave function psi, that's the initial state, and it's going to interact with a pointer through a von Neumann interaction. I haven't drawn it here, but most of you are familiar with that. But we're going to assume that the pointer begins in a very uncertain state, so that even after this interaction, there's no way on an individual trial that I could conclude from the pointer what the value of A really was. I would have to just look at the average shift over many, many trials. However, since I have not disturbed the system very much, I'm now free to do something else and say, before I look at the pointer, let me check whether the system is in the final state I'm interested in or not. So for instance, let me post-select on this particular green state and discard the orthogonal stuff. And only when this green bulb goes off and says, yeah, that's the post-selection you are interested in, shall I look at the pointer. And when I measure the pointer strongly, I'll get some pointer position. That'll be different each time. If I do this over and over again, every time I do that post-selection, I'll get a different pointer position. I'll build up a histogram. I will look at the mean shift of the pointer, and I'll say, well, I would interpret that to mean the average value of whatever observable this interaction was designed to measure for those cases where I prepared the particle in one state and found it in this other state. So I can now talk about the average value of this observable for a sub-ensemble rather than for the whole ensemble. I can use the past and the future information. Now you can calculate from standard quantum mechanics what that shift will be, and that's what Aharonov, Albert, and Weidman did, and they arrived at this interesting looking formula. All right, and it looks sort of related to expectation values. It's A sandwiched between stuff, at least it's that close to an expectation value. You might notice that if F and I are identical, in other words, if you do the trivial post-selection, just keep everything, this does reduce to the expectation value. And a few more lines will show you that if you just do this, but you do all possible post-selections and add them all up, weighted by how likely they are to succeed, you also get the expectation value, because of course that's equivalent to not doing any post-selection. All right? It has some funny properties. And these are part of what makes it controversial. In particular, you see that the overlap between F and I is in the denominator. So if the post-selection is very unlikely, in other words, there's a very small overlap between F and I, this quantity can blow up. So you can get results that don't even lie within the eigenvalue spectrum of A, which is what makes a lot of the results seem very strange. All right. In fact, they need not even be real. In general, this expression is complex, even for a Hermitian operator A. So there are lots of issues to think about with this. But on the other hand, it has lots of properties that I and a lot of other people think make it worthy of consideration, that give us the feeling that it is trying to teach us something about what the physical system is doing and about quantum mechanics. Okay? So let me show you one experiment where we used weak values to study a question I find exciting, which is whether or not you can break Heisenberg's uncertainty principle. So we all, of course, remember the Bohr-Einstein debates and these recoiling slits and how you resolve the question of complementarity by invoking the uncertainty principle, by saying any precise measurement of position is guaranteed to disturb momentum by an amount at least equal to h bar on 2 delta x. All right? So I've been teaching quantum mechanics for a while now, and I remind them about this quote. But for years, what I told the students is that may be a true statement, but it's not the interesting thing about the uncertainty principle. That's putting a limit on how well you can make a measurement, or how gently you can measure something. And the deeper statement that Heisenberg is giving us is about reality, or at least for those of us who believe that wave functions have anything to do with reality, which says that any quantum state in which the position is precisely determined is guaranteed to have an intrinsic uncertainty and momentum, regardless of what you can measure. It's just a statement about how much a quantum state can say about the universe, not about how well I can measure the universe. All right? But now I've changed my tune. Since we did this experiment, I have to admit to my students that the first statement is both less deep and less correct. And for those of us who believe in two-valued logic, less correct translates to incorrect. So let me give you a rotating arm approximation to understand this. There are some subtleties behind it that I won't go into, because if I do, I'll get them wrong anyway. But it should at least motivate why you might believe that that first statement is wrong after all. I should say, there are debates about whether or not Heisenberg ever said that. We went back and, like, you know, read the first pages of his papers on this, and he seems to be implying the statement that I made, but he never quite comes out and rigorously says it. And of course, the rigorous thing that we call the Heisenberg uncertainty relation was not proved by Heisenberg, but by Robertson and Walker and other people. So let us imagine the wave function of some particle that already has a small position uncertainty. All right, so I'm going to take the kind of extreme example where it even has compact support. It's guaranteed to be within this physical region. So naturally, that wave function has to have a big uncertainty in momentum. Now let me make an imprecise measurement of the position of the particle. Well, one way to do that is to try to send it through a slit with a finite width. If it gets through that slit, then I know that it was somewhere in that region. That is an imprecise position measurement. But if the slit is larger than the region of support of this wave function, you know, in the plane where it has compact support, then it's guaranteed to get through the slit without ever seeing the walls. So you might already have the intuition that by confirming that it was in this region where I already knew it was, I didn't need to disturb it at all. Obviously, after I measure its position to some uncertainty delta x, it must have a momentum uncertainty of at least h bar on 2 delta x. But it already had that uncertainty. I don't need to disturb it to get there. All right? So I think the problem in our usual interpretation of the uncertainty principle is we assume, oh, after the measurement, it must have an uncertainty. Therefore, I must have disturbed it. And what we left out is maybe that uncertainty was there all along, in which case the disturbance is not required. All right? I think I just said all of that. So it's Masano Ozawa who proved this stuff. He certainly agrees with the relationship that we all prove in university about the variances. But he says, if you try to interpret that same uncertainty relation to be a measurement precision, measurement disturbance relation, the way we like to talk about it sometimes, at least sort of at the high school level or the popular article level, so you define epsilon to be the precision of a measurement of A and eta to be the disturbance to the complementary variable B, this is just not true. And he proved a correct inequality, which you'll notice has the same commutator on the right, the same product on the left, but it has two additional and positive definite terms on the left, meaning that it is easy to satisfy this inequality while still violating the form that people might attribute to Heisenberg. All right. And since then, there's been other work. There are tighter versions of this inequality, but that's the basic idea. The problem is, how would you verify this? How do you measure the disturbance due to a measurement? What I would need to do is see what B was before the measurement, and then check what it was afterwards and see whether it had changed. But of course, if I measured B before the measurement, I'd be disturbing the system and I would be changing the whole setup. In particular, I'd probably be changing the right-hand side here. If I'm in an eigenstate of B, this thing will vanish. So there are two ways to do that, and one of them is a little bit indirect. It's kind of related to tomography, and that's what the neutron optics group in Vienna did a few years ago. But there's a second approach that was proposed by London Wiseman, which is to use weak measurement so that you can probe this thing B before the von Neumann measurement, but probe it so gently that you're not significantly disturbing the state. And then post-select on some value of B to see, has B been disturbed? Is the weak value of B a while ago different from the value upon which I post-selected? And that would be proof that you have disturbed B. All right, so we, in collaboration with Howard Wiseman, have used that idea a number of times, like to look at the effect of a witch path measurement in an interferometer to study how that disturbs the interference and so forth. But Lee Rosema and Dylan Mahler led the experiment to actually carry that out a few years ago in our lab. And here's the cartoon version of it. There's going to be some von Neumann measurement, some variable strength measurement of A, where the system becomes entangled with the probe, and that disturbs the system somehow. And we're going to try to characterize that. We're going to look at the disturbance of B and follow Ozawa's definition of that as the RMS difference between the value of B before and after the measurement, which we will infer by doing a weak measurement of B beforehand and then doing a final strong measurement of B and comparing those two things. We'll also have to define the precision of the measurement of A, and that'll be defined as the RMS difference between the value of A of the system before the measurement, in other words, a weak measurement of A here, and here's a slightly subtle point, the value of A on the probe at the end. Where is that? Down here on the probe. So not the value of A beforehand and afterwards, because you could do something you call a measurement that actually ignores the system entirely, just makes up a random number. And if you compared the value of A beforehand and afterwards, they'd be exactly equal. And you might say, oh, that was 100% precise measurement. But actually, no, it was a random number. So the precision of the measurement is not defined the same way the disturbance is. It's not how faithful A on the system is before and after. It's how faithful A read off on the probe is afterwards to the original value. All right, now we need variable strength measurements. We want to be able to see what happens as you make the measurement stronger or weaker, and we need to do weak measurements beforehand in the first place. So the question is, with qubits, how do you do that? How do you vary the strength of an interaction? And it turns out it's enough to just use a C-naught, but play around with the initial state of the probe. So imagine some system coming in, and it's going to act as the control on a target bit that I'll call the probe. If the probe begins in the state 0, then this alpha 0 plus beta 1 for the system evolves into this entangled state alpha 0, 0 plus beta 1, 1. And a measurement of Z2, the probe computational basis, gives me complete information about Z1, the state of the system. On the other hand, if I began in the state 0 plus 1 over root 2 for the probe, that's an eigenstate of naught, right? If I invert 0 plus 1, I still have 0 plus 1, which means it's an eigenstate of the C naught as well, which means I don't change it at all. It doesn't matter what the state of the system is. I get no information. So we can continuously tune between these two cases and adjust how much information we get about the system and how much entanglement we generate, so how much we disturb the system. So what we're going to do is have sort of three blocks. We're going to have this von Neumann measurement of Z for our qubit by coupling to some probe down here. And we will measure that probe afterwards, but we'll also measure the system afterwards. And beforehand, we will do a weak measurement with yet another probe, looking at either Z or this other variable X. All right, so we'll see the largest violation if we prepare the qubit in state Y equals 1, so the right-hand side be equal to 1, that commutator, and we'll look at the precision of the Z measurement and the disturbance to X. So we can change this weak measurement between a Z and an X measurement just by sandwiching it between some Hadamards. Gets a little more complicated in practice. We play some tricks using ideas from cluster state computing or teleportation so that with a pair of entangled photons, we can do these two different C naughts in a row. We do the first one on qubit 1, which we then teleport to qubit 2 to do the second C naught. Optically, it looks like this, where we use only two photons, but to generate the probes, we add some ancillary degrees of freedom. We use not only the polarization of the two photons, which is our initial qubit, where we have this entanglement and do our teleportation, but also path qubits. So we generate a pair of paths here that acts as one path qubit. Later on, we generate another pair of paths that acts as our other path qubit. So that at the end, we can measure both path qubits as well as a polarization. And this is what we get. As we vary the strength of the measurement, we find that the precision of the measurement goes down for stronger measurements, down being good, meaning lower uncertainty, so better measurement if you make it stronger. but the disturbance begins to go up. That's the measurement precision disturbance trade-off. And now all we have to do is multiply these two things and see where they show up. And what we find is if we just take the sort of Heisenberg product, they always fall below what you would think the Heisenberg limit is. Again, there are some subtleties that make this not equal to one. Anyone who cares, I'll talk about it with you later. But if you add the other terms, it goes way up here. We satisfy Ozawa's inequality, but we break Heisenberg's. All right, so it's yet another example where one of the ways we like to misinterpret Heisenberg is simply not true at all. There are a few other cases like that. But there is a way to quantify what that measurement disturbance uncertainty, disturbance precision relationship really is. And in fact, if you look at this thing, what you'll see is the simple example I gave you was, what if there was already an uncertainty in B, a delta B, then you don't need to disturb it. And if you look at these first two terms, that's exactly what it says. It says there is not a limit on eta of B, the disturbance to B. There's a limit on the sum of eta of B, the disturbance, and delta B, the initial uncertainty. Okay? And I don't know why there's a third term. Maybe there isn't in the tighter inequality. I've given up. All right. So that was the first example of measurement uncertainty trade-offs. Now I'm going to switch gears a little bit and talk about our latest work, this how to count to 8 on one photon. And the background has to do with quantum nonlinear optics. How do you generate huge interactions between two photons? Forget, Kevin, were you the one who first made this drawing? Maybe Jeff, I'm sure it was. So the question is, if you want to use photons to make a computer, a quantum computer, can you make a light enough switch that one photon will flip the switch and change what the second photon does? And that's what we call nonlinear optics. The problem is typical nonlinear optics does have effects that allow matter to mediate interactions between photons, but they're about a billion times weaker than what you would want in order to implement this kind of gate. So for a long time, people have been talking about what would happen if you could get stronger interactions, which in practice would look like this. You'd have some medium that I've drawn cartoonishly here, a single photon go through it, and it would affect some light beam that you'd probably measure by putting it in an interferometer. And you would see a phase shift here that depended on whether or not there was a photon there. So if that were big enough, you could do a quantum non-demolition measurement. And originally, people thought it would be nice if you had a pi phase shift. That would already be a kind of C phase gate. But Munro, Nemoto, and others pointed out that as long as you had a big enough phase shift that you could measure it on some probe, you could use that to do quantum non-demolition, and you could do some clever feedback tricks to turn that into deterministic quantum logic. So the thing is, if you sent a single photon in here, you'd need a pi phase shift in order to deterministically tell that there had been a signal photon there. But if you send through a coherent state with a million photons on average, its phase uncertainty is only a milliradian. So a milliradian phase shift would already be detectable, and this would already work. Which means, in principle, you can always do this just by going to an intense enough beam, as long as the only noise you have is quantum noise, right? And that's just not true in practice. So it becomes a technical question of how far can you push this? How big can you make the phase shift? And how quiet can you make an actual beam in the laboratory? But there's no fundamental reason you can't just go ahead and do this. All right? So we got interested in just pushing this, trying to see how big you could make what the theorists call weak nonlinearities because they're not pi, and the experimentalists call giant nonlinearities because they're still a million times bigger than what we normally have, and try to see what happens when you mix nonlinear optics and quantum optics. I'll just say in passing, there are now ideas based on Rydberg atoms that seem to be pushing this to the regime where the phase shift really is pi, and we're equally excited about those, and there's a lot of interesting work going on there. All right, so let me give you the sort of AMO primer on how you might do cross-phase modulation. In other words, get one beam's photon number to determine the phase shift on a second beam. Imagine what I call a probe beam sitting on a two-level atom. It experiences a refractive index that depends on where I'm tuned relative to resonance. All right, as you tune through a resonance, there's always this pi phase shift. You go through pi over 2 right on resonance. Now let me send a signal beam that couples this ground state to a third level. Well, the signal beam is made up of electromagnetic fields. Electric fields shift atomic energy levels. It's called the Stark shift. And in particular, if you come close to resonance, you can get a pretty big AC star shift, as we call it, which essentially changes the energy levels of these two states. But that means that the probe is no longer on a resonance. The probe now sees itself slightly detuned from resonance, which means it's going to pick up a slightly different index of refraction, a slightly different phase. And to first order, that change will be proportional to the size of this AC star shift, which means to the intensity in the signal pulse, or the number of photons in that signal pulse. Right, so that's how we're going to try to get a phase shift that depends on the number of photons here. Actually, we go through a little more complication. Atta Cimamoglu proposed 20 years ago or so that if you use this slightly more complicated level scheme with four levels, a phenomenon known as electromagnetically induced transparency, or EIT, you can get a much more sensitive measure of the same thing. But I don't think those details are important for us right now. Essentially, it means you've got to add one catalyst beam, this thing I call the EIT coupling beam. So we make a cloud of cold rubidium-85 atoms. We fire this beam through at 90 degrees. And we set up two telescopes that are focused right down onto the center of the cloud, one sending a signal pulse through this way that would be typically, well, we'd like it to be a single photon pulse, and a probe pulse that might be thousands or millions of photons coming through in the other direction. And we will then look at the phase of this probe pulse, which of course means I left something out. There has to be a kind of interferometer, and it's buried in here. There are actually two frequency components in that probe, and we measure their relative phase. All right, so the first thing we did was sort of at the classical level. We just begin with a pulse whose average photon number we know, and we turn it down, and we see a linear dependence of the measured phase shift on the photon number. If we put in more than about 10,000 signal photons, that's enough to saturate the atoms, and this breaks down. But we were able to go all the way down to coherent state pulses with, on average, one photon per pulse, and measure about a 10 microradian phase shift. And that was the first time in free space that anyone had measured the nonlinear phase shift due to pulses that had, on average, a single photon. There had been lots of work that extrapolated it down there. There had been work in cavity QED that was at this level. But this was the first free space example. Now, our real goal was to do this with heralded single photons. So we have a source of heralded single photons that are tuned to the rubidium resonance precisely so we can do this. But in its best days, it put out about 100 resonant photons a second. And as long as our phase shift is this low, and some other limitations are the way they are, and we only have 100 photons a second, we didn't believe we could accumulate enough data while keeping it stable to do that experiment yet. So we're still pushing towards that, but we had to play some other tricks for now that in the end I decided were probably more interesting than our original plan. So we'll see whether you agree with me or not. So forget the log-log plot. Let's go down. This is the phase shift we see for five photons. It's about 60 microradians for two photons, somewhere around 20 microradians. We wanted to make sure that this wasn't just some kind of funny systematic, so we also just changed the frequency of a beam. We flipped the sign of the detuning, and as it should, the phase shift changed sign. And then we thought, well, we went down to one photon, but we can go lower. These are coherent states. What happens if you send in half a photon? Any takers? What would the phase shift be if my signal pulse had half a photon? What you should be thinking is, there is no such thing as half a photon. But what I mean is a pulse with, on average, half a photon, which roughly speaking means that half the time there's vacuum and half the time there's one photon. And I should get 15 microradians half the time and zero half the time. Of course, my measurement uncertainty is much bigger than that, so I won't see that yet. If we had a real quantum non-demolition measurement that worked at the single-shot level, that's what we'd see. We would separate those into two bins. We can't do that. But what we can do is send in half a photon and then say, oh, wait, remember, this medium is transparent. That's what EIT stood for. So we can look at that signal photon after it goes through the medium, send it to a detector, and check whether the detector fired or not. And ideally, if it fires, we say, OK, that was one of the pulses that actually had a photon. And if it doesn't fire, we'll say that's one of the pulses that didn't have a photon. So there's an example of your post-selection, right? Based on this final event, I'm going to try to reason about what was there in the past, whether or not a photon actually went through my atom cloud. And we look at this phase depending on whether or not this went click. And sure enough, if it doesn't go click, we find almost no phase shift. And if it does go click, we see about a 15 microradian phase shift. So we wanted to think about this a little more carefully. So depending on the intensity of our incident coherent state, meaning just the peak of our Poisson distribution, we ask what would happen if a detector fired or didn't fire. Can we calculate how many photons were in the interaction region on average? Now, if it were a 100% efficient detector, then whenever it didn't fire, you'd know there was vacuum. All right, but detectors aren't 100% efficient. So it turns out if your detector is only 10% efficient, then when it doesn't fire, all you do is you revise your estimate down by about 10%. You say, I used to think there were 10 photons. If there were 10 photons, the detector probably would have fired. Maybe there were 9 photons. That actually turns out to be right. So if you just do the Bayesian analysis, take a Poisson distribution, and then take the probability of the detector firing or not firing, you get these curves. My students don't trust probability theory, so they did a very long second quantized calculation. You get the same result. But it shows something very interesting, which is that if you compare your best prediction of the mean photon number when the detector does not fire, that's this red curve, with your best estimate of the photon number when the detector does fire, that's basically this blue line here, they differ by one. They differ by essentially one. There are some extra details here because of background and other stuff you don't care about. But essentially, the estimate of the photon number when the detector fires is one greater than the estimate when it doesn't. Even if I sent in 5 photons, but I have such an inefficient detector that it doesn't always fire, every time it fires, I should say, yes, that was an additional photon. Yeah?
So the green dots, that's the ideal case, is it?
And then the green dotted lines are if you had a photon number resolving detector, but with imperfect inefficiency.
So I'm just wondering, you said the gap is 1, but it looks like it gets smaller down at the origin.
That's right. And the thing down at the origin is only due to additional background. If there were no dark counts, no background, Okay. Then they'd remain parallel.
Oh, that's the blue dotted one then?
That would be the blue dotted line. That's right. And then the other complication, as you know, is that most of our detectors don't tell 1 photon from 2, from 3, from 4. So this solid light blue line includes the average of all of those events that might occur. As you go to higher intensities, there's more and more of that. Okay, but that then depends on the efficiency setting. So the experimental data, we always adjusted the efficiency to prevent that from being too major. And these circles show the configurations we used experimentally. Okay. All right. That may sound a little hard to believe. Obviously, you could do the calculation. But as usual, it turns out once you know the answer, you can come up with a simpler way of understanding it, which is the following. Quantum optics people know this. The way that you can model an inefficient detector is to imagine that you had a perfectly efficient detector, but some jerk had put a beam splitter with an imperfect transmission before your detector. All right, and that's a mathematically equivalent system. So you imagine that your coherent state is coming in, and you now have a beam splitter with a transmission of eta, and then a perfect detector, and then a port that's just discarded that has amplitude root 1 minus eta. What would happen if you did this? Well, coherent state hitting a beam splitter simply gives you a product state. It gives you the coherent state root eta times alpha here, root 1 minus eta alpha over here. What is the physical meaning of having a product state? People often don't stress this enough. The meaning is that you cannot learn anything about one state by measuring the other. They're completely independent, right? So what that means is that, whoops, I thought I had it written down. I'll have to say it in words. When I look at whether or not this detector fires, I'm measuring something about this state 1. That does not change anything about my understanding of state 2. So what's the average number of photons in this mode? It's 1 minus eta, the reflectivity, times alpha squared, whether or not this detector goes click. Okay? But since this is a 100% efficient detector, if it doesn't go click, that means there are 0 photons in this mode. If it does go click, that means there's a photon in that mode. So the total photon number is just the square of this thing, alpha squared times the reflectivity, or the inefficiency of the detector, either plus 1 or not plus 1. That's all this calculation is confirming. Okay? But the reason that excites us is because it means no matter what I send in, and whether or not I have it properly calibrated, if I look at the difference between what happens when my detector fires and when my detector doesn't fire, I am looking at the effect of a single quantum. Even though our heralded single photon source was not ready for prime time and we couldn't send in single photons deterministically, I know what the effect of one quantum is. If I was wrong in my calibration, and when I thought I had a pulse that had one photon per pulse, there were really 10 photons per pulse or 0.1 photons per pulse, it wouldn't matter. The quantum nature comes in because of the way the detector functions. Okay, so I actually found that really exciting. And as you see, it works. There's a shift that's roughly the same in all of these cases. It flips sign if you flip the sign of the detuning. And again, we're paranoid, we're experimentalists. We changed a lot of other things. It turns out if there are no atoms, it doesn't work. If there's no coupling beam, it doesn't work. If you're detuned way far from resonance, it doesn't work. So it's not just some electrical spike in the lab looking like a phase shift. It really is an effect due to this nonlinear interaction. And it really entangles these different optical beams. We're really looking at entanglement now between two different optical beams. Very weak entanglement, but with measurable effects. All right, so now I want to go on to the question of whether the single photon can have the effect of 100 photons. Some of you know why that picture is there. So this goes back to the original paper on weak measurement, which actually had this bizarre title, How the Result of a Measurement of a Component of the Spin of a Spin 1/2 Particle Can Turn Out to be 100. How you can convince the editors of Physical Review Letters to let you put the word of four times in a row in your title. And it comes back to this point that the weak value, the average shift of the pointer, has this funny denominator that can get really small. So even if you're measuring S sub z on a qubit, if f and I are nearly orthogonal, your average shift might be huge. And this is this thing that's called weak value amplification that I said has been controversial. Paul Kwiat's group first used this to do a really sensitive measure, measurement of a very small effect known as the spin Hall effect for light. John Howell's group with Andrew Jordan's theoretical support went on to do a lot of interesting work demonstrating how they could use these ideas to do high precision measurements. But whether or not this is actually better than what you could do without weak measurements remains a topic of debate, and I'll say a little bit about it. But what I want to do is just argue that that original AAV paper is equivalent to something that we can do optically. A spin is, of course, equivalent to any other two-level system. So instead of asking about a spin component of some electron, I can take a photon, my system, and put it in a superposition of two different paths and ask about projections onto those two different paths. Basically, I can ask, how many photons are in arm B? Well, obviously, that should be either 0 or 1. That's kind of like a spin operator. But if I begin by preparing a particular superposition, A minus B over root 2, so I take a photon, let it hit a beam splitter with a pi phase shift somewhere, and then I do a post-selection on a different superposition that is nearly but not quite orthogonal. If I just said A plus B, that would be orthogonal. So I could set up this interferometer so that no light hit this detector. But if I change the reflectivity and transmissivity of this last beam splitter to 0.5 plus delta and 0.5 minus delta, there's some small chance the photon will come out this port, which is a projection onto that state. And if in that case I ask, what is the photon number in B? What is the weak value of the photon number in B? You can go through the calculation, but just because the overlap of F and I is small, you get something that looks like 1 over delta. All right? So remember what that means operationally. It means that if you had some interaction that tries to measure the photon number in B, but does so weakly so it doesn't disturb the system too much, its average shift will be given by this formula. Well, that's exactly what we have, right? We were trying to measure photon number. Before it was a bug that we couldn't measure it very well. Now it's a feature. Oh, look, we have a weak measurement automatically just because we have too much noise in our system. If I look at the phase shift here, that's the pointer variable. That's what's trying to tell me about the number of photons in B. And even if I send in only one photon, it should be possible to make this arbitrarily large. We should be able to measure a photon number of 100, even if we only sent in one photon. Okay? So a photon in the hand turns out to be worth 1,000 in the vacuum chamber. So far, that's only true base 2, as you'll see. This is the experiment, more modern version of the same kind of picture. We've got the atoms, we've got the coupling beam. One modification, which is that in addition to the probe beam that comes through here and has these two different frequency components beating, we now need an interferometer for the signal as well. The signal needs to have two different paths. But for us, those paths are going to be different circular polarizations. So we'll prepare a linearly polarized signal that includes right-handed and left-handed components. But we set up the atomic system in such a way that one of those interacts really strongly and the other one almost not at all. So you can almost think of this interaction as measuring how many right-hand circular photons are there, even though what you sent in was a linearly polarized photon. And then at the end, instead of just detecting the signal photon, as we did before, we'll detect the signal photon in a nearly orthogonal linear polarization. Or I forget. No, it's probably slightly elliptical polarization in this case. Okay. And here's what we find. As we change that overlap delta, the measured phase shift starts to diverge. The single photon phase shift, for comparison, is now down here, around 8 microradians, because some things changed. And it goes all the way up to above 60 microradians. So really, the effect of this one photon can be as large as about 8 times the single photon phase shift that we normally expect. All right. This also happens to be the first optical example of a weak measurement experiment where we're actually physically entangling two distinct systems. All the other weak measurement experiments done in optics, sorry, I take that back, all the other deterministic weak measurement experiments done in optics had to couple different degrees of freedom of the same photon, which I don't really care about. The math is the same, but the funny point about that is you could make any prediction you liked about those systems using Maxwell's equations. There's nothing quantum about them, nothing necessarily quantum. So those of us who like quantum mechanics, that's OK. Maxwell's equations are just a consequence of quantum mechanics. But people who take a different perspective say, oh, you haven't proved there was anything quantum. It's just a classical wave effect. So here you really can't do that. It's really two different entangled beams. I believe there's no classical explanation, although we haven't gotten around to like actually trying to test a witness for entanglement or anything like that. It should be possible in principle. Before I switch gears yet again, maybe I should just slow down and ask if there are any questions about that experiment? Or you can just take your breath before I move on. That's fine. All right. As I said, I'm curious about whether or not this is good for anything practical. This is one of these experiments that claimed that it could be. They used a kind of weak measurement classical interferometer to measure beam deflections. You know, how much is my hand jittering? By something on the order of 200 femtoradians. I apologize to those of you who've already heard this comparison, but I can never resist it. When some journalist asked me about this, I sat there staring at that number, wondering what the hell is a femtoradian. And I finally worked it out, and I realized what it means is if I took this laser pointer and I pointed it at the moon, and I could keep my hand stable to only 200 femtoradians, the spot on the moon would be moving by the thickness of a human hair. That's the kind of precision these people are talking about. So it's really remarkable, but saying I used technique A and I did a really good measurement is different from proving that you did better with technique A than you could have with any other technique. Right? It still leaves this open question. So here's the short version of the story. I won't go into a lot of details. As you make the overlap between F and I small, the weak value gets big. So you might think that makes your measurement easier. But the post-selection probability goes as the square of that overlap. So to make your pointer shift 10 times bigger, you've got to get 100 times less data. And hopefully you all at least once took a laboratory class and remember something about root n. If you have 100 times less data, that hurts your signal to noise by a factor of 10. So these effects just cancel out. It's interesting. They don't do worse than that, right? You keep less data and sort of get everything. That's already nice. But it doesn't improve your signal to noise. Now, that's true as long as the noise is what some people like to call statistical. Meaning that each data point you take has an uncorrelated value of the noise field. So you do a random walk and you really benefit from that root n. If, on the other hand, the noise is perhaps some slowly fluctuating thing, whereas I take data at a higher and higher rate, I don't actually get to average that fluctuator away any better, then it becomes interesting to ask whether this could help you out. And we think it can. We think that the noise stops dropping as 1 over root n once there are correlations in that noise. And then there's an advantage to doing this. There's some problems, which is people say, you weak measurement guys, you want to do post-selection. You want to throw stuff out. How can you get more information by throwing stuff out? No, none of us is claiming that you get more information by throwing anything out. What we're claiming is that you get more information by doing the second measurement and correlating the results of measurement on the system with the results of the measurement on the probe. And furthermore, we're claiming that in a lot of cases, most of the information is concentrated in a small subset. All right? If you keep everything, you will always do marginally better, no question about that. But we think it's this question of doing two measurements and correlating them. And we've been working with Andrew Jordan and Jeff Tollickson on writing a paper to explain this perspective. But the cartoon of the plots we end up is the following, that normally, as you turn your photon rate up, you get a better and better signal-to-noise ratio. But if there are correlations in the noise, and you're just doing blind averaging, eventually you already have one photon per correlation time. Going any further doesn't help you. This is going to flatten out. And if you do weak value amplification, this keeps climbing until you reach one post-selected photon per correlation time. So you can keep getting that 1 over root n improvement longer and longer. It turns out that there is a better thing you can do. And if you do the optimal kind of post-selection, it does marginally better than the weak value, and it may continue afterwards. And for those of you who know something about experiment, I actually think it turns out that this technique is usually equivalent to what common sense would have told you to do anyway. Just do some intelligent kind of background subtraction, something like lock-in amplification. That already is the optimum. So what we're looking for is cases where we can argue that it's easier to do weak value amplification and almost exactly as good. All right, and that, I still think, remains a kind of open question. There was an unexpected advantage, though, and Mateen Halaji, who led this last experiment, noticed this only when he was writing the conclusion to our preprint, because he decided to compare his experiment with Amir Feyzpour's experiment, the previous one without the weak value amplification. In that first experiment, no weak value amplification, we had about a billion trials, which meant 300 million events that had photons. And we measured this phase shift with an uncertainty of about 4 microradians. And in Mateen's version, we had not quite as many trials, about 830 million. About 200 million of those had successful post-selections. And his uncertainty was 0.6 microradians. So with very comparable resources, he actually had a much lower uncertainty. And if you think about it more carefully, it turns out to really be one of these issues of how do you define your resources, because to get these post-selections, he actually used many more photons. So he had fewer pulses and fewer clicks at the detector, but he actually had more photons. So you may or may not be surprised that he gets a better number here. But then again, I think it's a hint that when you're analyzing a real experiment, you'd better ask, what is the expensive resource? And maybe there are real world cases where the resource is something that goes this way and there would really be an advantage. Okay. All right, so now to switch gears, I'm going to tell you about something that we haven't even done yet, so it should be relaxing. And it's related to an old question, dates back to 1935, which is how long does it take a particle to tunnel through a barrier? We all know how to calculate the probability that it tunnels through the barrier, but if it looked at its watch after it popped through, what would it find? Right. I won't go into all the reasons that that's controversial, but I will say that if you do any of the naive things, you find that it's very easy to get regimes where this time seems to be smaller than the thickness of the barrier divided by the speed of light. And people at first assumed they did the calculation wrong. They didn't. They assumed they made an approximation that was no good. They didn't. They assumed that it was because they were using a non-relativistic theory. It wasn't. It really just comes down to thinking carefully about what these results mean. And basically, what happens with most of these definitions is you find a time that becomes independent of the thickness of the barrier. All right, so the problem then is let the barrier thickness go to infinity. Eventually, the barrier thickness is greater than CT, whatever that constant time is. All right, so here's one of the proposals to try to get around the naive things. It was kind of due to Butiker picking up on ideas from Bass and Rybachenko. That are known as the Larmor clock, collectively. So here's the idea. Suppose I've got an electron and it goes through some region, tunnels through a square barrier, for instance. And that electron has a spin. So let's imagine the spin along what I think is the x direction. Yes. Suppose I put a magnetic field inside the barrier along z. We know that an x spin will precess about a z field at the Larmor frequency. So after the particle is transmitted, you could see how far it had precessed and say, oh, well, that must just be equal to the Larmor frequency times however long it spent in the field. That would be a nice operational way to define that interaction time. What Boudicker realized is that the earlier work left out something important, which is that no matter how small you make the field, there's a second tendency. This X spin can be thought of as a superposition of spin up and spin down. In the magnetic field, those have different energies, so they effectively see different barrier heights. So the aligned spin sees a lower barrier. It's much more likely to tunnel than the anti-aligned spin. That means that not only does the spin precess, it tends to align if you only look at transmission. All right? And I think the idea in the early work was, well, let's just make B small so we can neglect that effect. But both of these effects are first order in B, so you can't do that. And in fact, this effect is generally larger than the other one. So Boudicker kind of waved his hands and said, huh, there isn't one angle, there are two angles. Let's add them in quadrature and call that the tunneling time. And he liked that because it happened to agree with something he'd written in a different paper for a different reason. But actually, mathematically, it turns out that another approach people had looked at, which was just looking at all the Feynman paths that are transmitted through this barrier and taking the e to the is over h bar sum of the durations of those paths, gave you a complex number for the time, which a lot of people hated, but these two angles correspond to the real and imaginary parts of that complex number. And it turns out that if you just take the weak value of an observable that sort of feels like the time spent in the barrier, it also gives you the same exact complex number. All right, so mathematically, we're pushed more and more towards the idea that there's something with dimensions of time that's complex, and the real and imaginary parts are describing these two different physical effects. We can go further than that. Instead of just talking about the time spent in the whole barrier, you could imagine confining the magnetic field to a small region and moving where that region was to measure how long the particle has spent in each region of the barrier. And these are our predictions. And again, straight quantum mechanics, although we worked it out using the weak measurement formalism. Depending on your post-selection, whether you look at the transmitted particles or the reflected ones, you'll get a different result. And to me, that's what makes this problem interesting. I mean, all right, tunneling is cool, blah, blah, blah. But the idea that you could look at two different ensembles and say, actually, I can show you the transmitted particles have a different history from the reflected particles. It seems like common sense, of course, but it would be nice to see that. And this is the prediction. Reflected particles only ever see the first exponential decay length. They never go any deeper into the barrier. Transmitted particles, on the other hand, see the first exponential decay length and the last one as well. Somehow they got out the other side. By time reversal, you could conclude that they should have spent some time there. But oddly, at least if you focus on the real part of the weak value, none of them spends much time in the center of the barrier. The wave function is just small there, and that leads to this result. So somehow this seems to connect with the idea that they get transmitted too quickly. It's as though the particles only see the beginning and the end of the barrier, and no matter how thick you make it, the ones that get transmitted just sort of skipped that region in the middle. I would love to see that experimentally. That's what we've been pushing towards. Well, that's just a movie. You could also imagine time resolving it. There's a wave packet coming in. Little by little, the incident wave packet gets smaller and smaller, as well as developing interference fringes. And the transmitted wave packet just builds up. But at no point is there anything in the middle. And for full disclosure, that is true of the real part. The imaginary part behaves differently. There is an imaginary part in the middle. And my interpretation of this is that the real part is telling you how much does the system affect a pointer device. And it turns out that a system tunneling through a barrier doesn't have much effect on a pointer sitting in the middle of the barrier. The imaginary part tells you about the back action, the thing that doesn't happen classically. And what it's telling you is, how sensitive is the system to the pointer that's interrupting its tunneling? Well, there the answer is just this WKB integral e to the minus kappa x. Doesn't matter where you put the pointer. If it's giving you an energy shift, the particle will be very sensitive to that. Its transmission probability will be very sensitive to that. So here's how we're trying to do it. The simplest experimental sequence we could imagine is we begin with our atoms, which are in a Bose condensate in a magnetic trap. Turn the magnetic trap off, they fall under gravity, they expand a bit. But atoms are actually repelled by light if light is detuned to the blue, to higher frequency than their resonance. So we can focus a laser beam down, a blue laser beam, to make a sort of 1 micron thick sheet of light. And when the atoms hit that, there should be an interaction and some should tunnel. So we've begun doing those experiments, and there's a movie of what we call the rest trap. repulsive, I don't know what that stands for anymore. It's obvious what it means. This is a sort of stroboscopic movie of atoms that are sitting on a shelf made of a beam of light. And what you see is first some are too hot, and they just plop right over the barrier. And then the atoms sit there just sort of sloughing off to the sides of the desk until they fall off the two sides. All that time, there are probably some atoms tunneling through as well. In these movies, we don't have the resolution to look at that. But we recently wrote a paper really studying how they tunnel there. This isn't a very well-controlled situation, so we'd like to do something a little better. And while the atoms are tunneling through the barrier, what we want to do is confine a magnetic field to the barrier. I don't know how to confine a magnetic field to 1 micron. But what we do know how to do is to focus laser beams down to 1 micron. And by coupling two different spin states with laser beams, you can make a sort of fictitious magnetic field. These two states will undergo a Rabi flopping that's analogous to that Larmor flopping. So ideally, we'd be able to move those probe beams around within the barrier and really measure the effect I was talking about. So we're going to take our atoms that are now trapped in a crossed dipole trap, which acts like a sort of waveguide for atoms, intersect a blue beam that repels them with that, add Raman beams that act as a probe, fire the atoms at the barrier. Some will be transmitted, some will be reflected. And now we'll just measure how much spin rotation did each of those get. And that should tell us how long did they experience the effect of those Raman beams. So we have each of the elements of this partway. For instance, we have the atoms in the barrier. We did something recently. We turned that barrier into a double barrier, because the thing with a barrier is some atoms are always transmitted and some reflected, because some are hot enough to be transmitted and some are so cold they're guaranteed to be reflected. To have tunneling, you want the atoms that are right at that boundary, that are just below the barrier height and have some amplitude to be transmitted and some amplitude to be reflected. So to verify that that was going on, we wanted to see interference, show there were some atoms that could have done either thing. So we made a double barrier, which makes a kind of Fabry-Perot, and this is our first preliminary evidence that the damn thing works. This is a movie. Each horizontal slice is a different time slice. This is a condensate being fired in from the right. And when it hits the barrier, you see some atoms are really hot, they just go over the double barrier. Some are cold, they just get reflected. But then there's this dot that appears stuck in the middle. And we think that's the atoms that happen to have been on resonance with the Fabry-Perot and just got stuck inside and are going to slowly leak out over the ring down time of the cavity. So that's very recent and has us really excited. We're also able to do the Stern-Gerlach kind of measurement that lets us extract the spin information. And although we haven't been able to put all the elements together yet, I can show you that for atoms moving in free space, as we change their incident velocity, we find a different phase shift depending on what that velocity is. And the punchline is that the time atoms spend in a given region seems to be proportional to 1/1 the velocity. So that is the highest tech confirmation that t is distance divided by velocity that I think we've ever done. And we're hoping to be able to combine that with the tunneling case, where it's a little more exciting. So thank you for your patience, and I will leave you with those conclusions. And we'll be happy to entertain questions, obviously.
Yeah. I have a question about the weak measurement.
Yeah.
So you define weak measurement with the wave function, how wave function is disturbed. But the experimental one we normally do is control the coupling Hamiltonian. So the word weak defined by wave function and some operational thing using control Hamiltonian. Are these two necessarily the same?
Yeah, I think the important point is that the magnitude of the shift you get on the pointer is small compared to the quantum uncertainty in the pointer. So you could get that regime either by making the interaction weaker or by making the initial uncertainty bigger. And the point is you need a scale to compare to. So those are really equivalent. Yeah. And that's what guarantees that you don't get much information on a single shot, which is sort of the flip side of it being weak. Yeah.
So when you did this Heisenberg Ozawa experiment, there was like this flurry of papers afterwards saying, oh no, Heisenberg wasn't really wrong, or Ozawa was wrong. What, like, was there a conclusion there that people no, come
no.
to consensus?
It's a question of definitions. So it turns out you can define uncertainties for which that expression turns out to be right, but they are state-independent uncertainties. So in my language, instead of asking how much did this state get disturbed by the measurement, you're asking how much would this measurement have been able to disturb some state, not the one I sent in, but some other state. And I personally find it kind of ridiculous to conflate those two questions. Obviously, if I began in a state that had zero uncertainty in P and I measured X, then yes, all the disturbance has to come from my measurement. And I could have sent in such a state. What we're asking is, did it actually disturb this state by that much? But there are people who argue that that's not a reasonable definition to take. I don't understand why they feel that way.
On the top of that experiment, in the data you plotted, it seemed like you were above...
For the Ozawa?
It seems like you were slightly above the threshold.
No, I don't think so. So the threshold is the black solid line.
Right. So just within error of the threshold. Because I would have expected, due to sort of imprecision, that you'd be slightly below the threshold.
Well, the red points are always below the threshold, and the error bars on these are, I think, smaller than the dots, which is why we don't
so
see them.
So the black line is the, which threshold? The Heisenberg?
That's right. The black line is the Heisenberg threshold.
I thought you said that the solid yellow line was the Ozawa threshold.
No, sorry. The threshold, the right-hand side, is the same in both cases. It's the left-hand side that changes. So the yellow is the Ozawa left-hand side, which is indeed greater than the threshold. And the red dots are the Heisenberg left-hand side, which violates the inequality because it's smaller than the threshold.
Got it.
I went through that too quickly. Thank you.
While we're on the slide, look at the dotted lines.
The dotted lines are what we would have expected for an ideal measurement with this measurement strength. But because of the way we implement the measurements using teleportation and so forth, we have a lot of imperfections. So the solid lines are a simulation of what we expect given our actual experimental fidelities. And the dotted lines are the ideal.
Any questions? Okay, let's thank you from again.